is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Guys, I'm fully charged. I'm ready to go. I've got the solar panels, the power plugs, like, jammed right into me. I've got the phase three. It's all happening. Folks, it's screen watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon,
yes.
Big show this week. Big show.
Yes.
We do this on a podcast. We talk about the movies. We talk about the TV shows. Simon, the movies, what's on the docket?
Okay, this week we'll be looking at the new Gal Gadot film. Hello, screen watchers. Hello, Dan. The new Gal Gadot film on Netflix. It's called Heart of Stone. And we'll be looking at a film called Blackberry. Who remembers that wonderful little device from many, many years ago and how quickly it rose to the top and then dropped away just as quickly? So there's a new movie telling that story. What are you reviewing, Dan?
Look, I've got some hot takes about Blackberries that I'm pretty keen to drop during the podcast. But I've got some TV shows. I'm going to talk about a brand new Netflix TV series, 6-episode first season, probably running up to 3 seasons, but we'll see how that plays out. It's called The Chosen One. And coming soon, a revival, a revamp, if you will, a reimagining.
Nice.
Classic Australian sitcom. It was called Mother and Son, and now it's back, and it's called Mother and Son. I'm going to give you the skinny on the first episode, which I watched the other day. Yeah, that's what we're doing. Folks, we've got that. Also, there's a brand new movie out called Strays. We don't have a review of that one, but I can say I've read a few reviews this morning. Nobody's really got a lot of positive things to say about it. What's going on there, Simon?
That's my phone ringing. I'm going to just close that off. I do apologize.
You close that off. It's highly unprofessional for this amateur podcast.
You're going to cut that out?
Yeah, no, it's staying in there. I mean, podcast gold like this, Simon, why would you want to lose it? So look, we've got this movie Strays. We're not reviewing it because neither of us have gotten around to seeing it yet. We might talk about it on next week's show if we've got something to say. But because there's this movie about dogs out in the marketplace, we thought, let's talk about dogs. Let's talk about our favorite dogs of screen, the big screen, the small screen, whatever makes our lists. Each of us have 5 of them. So by the end of this podcast, you'll hear possibly 10 dogs who are worthy of your consideration. For what?
At any point, will your dogs do like they usually do and start scratching themselves or licking themselves or playing with their collars in the background there? Because that would be the ambient noise.
I can't speak for the dogs, but I know that I'll be doing that during at least one of your reviews.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, let's find out.
Our YouTube channel. And you can often see Dan scratch or lick or play with himself on the internet. Well, who hasn't seen that? It's good to talk to you, Dan.
It's not that sort of YouTube channel, Simon. Also, we've got more going on. We're going to talk about what else we've been watching. We've got in history. We've got birthdays. We've got so much to shake sticks at and poke around. I've got nothing. Simon, let's please dive right into some reviews.
It stinks.
Simon, first up, let's do a movie. It's a TV movie on a thing called Netflix.com. Simon, tell us all about Heart of Gold, Heart of Glass. Heart of Stone.
Heart of Stone, my friend. Let's play a clip.
You know what you signed up for. No friends. No relationships. What we do is too important. When governments fail.
Gal Gadot plays Rachel Stone, a.k.a. Nine of Heart. She's a member of a secret peacekeeping operation called The Charter, who is undercover as a rookie MI6 tech agent. It's a job that takes her and her offsiders, played by Paul Reedy and Jing Lucy, to places all over the globe, the Swiss Alps, to London, to Lisbon, to Senegal, and to Iceland, just to prove how expensive these films can be to make. Matthias Schweighofer plays the Jack of Hearts. He's Rachel's tech aide. He's always plugged into a supercomputer known as the Heart, which allows him to use surveillance data to help her in her missions. And this data visualizes in front of him, which he manipulates with his hand, which was great when Tom Cruise did it all those years ago. And Minority Report seems a bit old hat nowadays, but there it is. And it doesn't look too bad. Yeah, that's exactly like it is for those of you watching the Dan do his Tom Cruise. Also in the mix is Jamie Dornan, who we know can be a slithery, slimy beast from some of his other portrayals. And he certainly turns out to be in this film as Parker, who sort of has the most villainous moments, but doesn't really lean into them too much. He's a little bit of a vanilla in this one, which Jamie Dornan's capable of being. Also in the mix and amping up the both the female presence and the international presence is the lovely actress Alia Bhatt from India. She plays a hacker called Kia, who's just one big walking cliche for most of the film. The one main guy in this who's worthy of any note is a model turned actor called Yon Kotakarena. He plays this bleach blonde baddie with giant eyebrows who seems to go as over the top as he wants to go in making this film a little bit more fun than it probably deserves to be. Now, the thing is, Gal Gadot should be a huge movie star. If we had movie stars anymore, she would be right front and center because she's very likable on screen, certainly very action-oriented, but she has instead spun her career off into this Netflix fodder and no doubt taking big paychecks for it. This film opens with a very cringy, over-the-top CGI action piece, which could be just cut from any other James Bond or Mission Impossible film. In fact, the villain itself, this AI, which can sort of take over the internet all over the world, is pretty much the same e-baddie as was in MI7. This is written by a guy called Greg Rooker, who did The Old Guard based on his own graphic novel a few years ago with Charlize Theron, which was pretty good. It shows that he can do action and have some fairly well-developed characters, but there's nothing in this film that indicates that he was anywhere near as inspired as he was with that movie. I wish this could have been a better film. Having said all of that, I got to say, as it sort of ground into its second hour and some of the action scenes started to kick in, I didn't really hate it like some of the reviews suggest. It's at 30%, I think, in Rotten Tomatoes. But this is such a by-the-numbers, cookie-cutter Hollywood action film. It's a shame that so much money and so many big names got attached to it. You expect more from them. Or do we?
Look, so I'm kind of interested in this one because I quite like Greg Rucker. He's a comic book writer I've got a lot of respect for. He tends to do characters pretty well. He's usually a sort of big idea kind of a guy, but always grounds his ideas fairly nicely. So I was quite interested to see his adaptation of The Old Guard, which he did for Netflix. I'm interested in seeing this. Haven't gotten around to it yet. The general sort of consensus seems to be that it's a step above a lot of the Netflix big budget action films from the last couple of years, but certainly a little bit disposable. So not entirely out of line with your approach to it. Look, I'm probably going to give it a look. I think it's a Sunday afternoon movie where low investments and, you know, medium return.
That's exactly what it is. Well said.
Mm. Anyway, shall we move on?
Let's roll in.
Yeah, I've got a brand new Netflix series. It's called The Chosen One.
People are always going to be looking for us. Just trying to keep you safe.
So, Simon, you hear a phrase like The Chosen One. What do you think it's about?
Religion, my friend, the second coming, the new Lord, and all that malarkey. Is it not about that?
No, that's exactly what it's about. So, look, this is a project that I was kind of curious about, but also highly trepidatious about. It's based on a comic book series by Mark Miller. And the thing with Mark Miller is that he's always seemed a little bit opportunistic. And I would say that nothing speaks to his opportunism more than his comic book series Chosen, or The Chosen One, or American Jesus. Because this is a property that he first published, I don't know, like 15 years ago or something. Look, I've got a copy of it right here.
Is this the Mark Miller of the Batman Mark Miller?
I don't know who the Batman Mark Miller is, but he may have written Batman at some point.
Oh, that was Frank Miller, wasn't it?
That was Frank Miller, yeah. So he's a notable.
I get my...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Mark Miller may have written Batman at some point. I don't think so, though, but, you know, maybe at some point. Okay, so he did this book called Chosen back in 2005. So I've got the collection here. So it might have been 2004 even. It came out, and it did okay, I guess. I mean, I bought a copy, so, you know, they made at least one sale. But then he ended up doing a second series, and when the second series, like it was a sequel series, and when that came along, he completely changed the name of it to try to gin up a bit more interest, because the name Chosen, pretty generic. He ended up changing the title of it to be called American Jesus, kind of explaining sort of bang right there undercover what it's about, which is, as you said, Second Coming, yada, yada. And so suddenly American Jesus ends up becoming the chosen one when it becomes a Netflix series, because I'm guessing American Jesus sounds a little bit difficult in terms of getting attention without protests. Would probably be the reason why I think Netflix have probably opted for another name. And it just kind of feels like just even embracing that just kind of felt a little bit opportunistic of Mark Miller's got a long-term deal with Netflix. He's had a few shows up that haven't really performed all that well. I think it's a bit of a dud deal, but also I don't really like Mark Miller very much. So yeah, I'm putting that out there. So, the problem with Mark Miller as a writer is that basically he always leans towards like being a bit of an edgelord. If people don't know the Mark Miller of comics, they know the Mark Miller of cinema, in that his best known thing is probably Kick-Ass. Okay, Yeah. And I don't know if he had anything to do with the Kingsman movies at all. I'm not too sure. I'm not a Mark Millerologist. Okay, so whatever. Okay, but just like thinking about the sort of edgelord opportunism of Mark Miller. If you think about what they've done here, it isn't just that they've changed the name of it, but instead, if you start watching this, you'll notice something very different, which is that it's no longer in English. It's a Latino American production now. Okay. And it just kind of feels as though he was looking for like an angle to really lean into. And that's the angle he's gone with it. So
he went with Californian Sunshine.
Yeah. So this isn't an English language production. There is some English in it, but it's largely Spanish. Although most people, based on the way that Netflix works, it'll just go to whatever the default language is. So expect some dubbing over the top of it. Yeah, basically what you're going to get is some fairly shonky dialogue just generally across the board. You're going to get a storyline, which I was actually kind of curious about this. I haven't pulled this book off the shelf for like quite a few years on account of the fact I don't think it's very good. But if you watch the first episode of the program, the very end of episode one is basically page 4 of this book. And boy, did it feel it, because that first episode really plods along. They've taken it from being this main sort of, you know, potential Jesus character to suddenly being this character, but with like 5 friends who all have like their own stuff going on. None of them particularly interesting. Yeah. I guess, one could probably look at it being a bit sort of Stranger Things-like, but at least Stranger Things sort of lends into them actually being sort of realized characters, even if somewhat stereotypical, particularly in that first season, but at least lent into the 80s, and there was something fun about that. There's nothing really fun about these characters. There's nothing super engaging about them. They're all cookie cutter, at least in like the chosen book, like the character's a bit of an edgelord and there's, you know, an angle to him, but like none of that's really in this TV show. Like it's just dull. And then Simon, here's the thing. Yeah. There's one more thing. There's one thing I could say about this that could maybe sell it and convince people to watch it. But for me to do that gives away what I'm assuming is probably the twist of episode 6 of the first season. So I'm not going to do that. Okay.
Right.
But just from a top level thing, the idea is, and you can tell this from the name, we're watching someone who is potentially a reborn Jesus Christ who's come back to earth.
That's what I was going to get to, because it was called American Jesus. Now, I'm a little confused here, because I knew of, there's been a bit of talk about The Chosen or The Chosen One as a project that came out of Angel Studios,
which unrelated.
Is a studio at the moment that is making a whole bunch of dollars out of Sound of Freedom, most of it their own dollars by all accounts. But so these are two different things. They're not
unrelated. Together. Nothing to do with it. But Jesus is a pretty common character who I think a number of people feel they've got some sort of IP ownership of.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So The Chosen One, we should point out that it does feature Diana Agron, who possesses a lot of the qualities prized by the superficial male. So I'll probably have a look at it just because she's in it. But otherwise, this sounds like a potentially interesting show that maybe falls short.
It's based on a book that isn't very interesting. So, if you want to say it's potentially interesting, I would maybe argue that no, it's not.
I quite like these sort of stories. There was a great film with David Duchovny called The Rapture many, many years ago that Mimi Rogers was in. And I love these sort of placing spirituality and placing sort of religious iconography in a very modern setting and seeing how the modern world deals with it and bringing with it all the mysticism and all the powers that, you know, biblical powers that come of that sort of setting. So I'm kind of on board from that point of view. A young Jesus walking around SoCal is kind of cool to me, but yeah, maybe it's just not what it could have been.
Yeah, look, my understanding with The Rupture is that there's a David Duchovny like full frontal nude scene in it, but I haven't seen the film.
Yeah, I've seen the film a couple of times. Yes, there is a David Duchovny full frontal nude scene, which was kind of his thing back in the day when he was like pre-X-Files.
Well, Red Shoe Diaries.
Out-peened quite often, from what I understand.
I don't think that's true. I think it was just in this one movie. But he was the host and narrator of the Red Shoe Diaries for, you know, 6 or 7 seasons or something. Longer than he needed to.
He has a threesome scene with Mimi Rogers and one other person in The Rapture. I think we're going to have to put an e-sticker next to our podcast name now, are we?
No, I didn't think we need to go into that much detail about what he's up to in The Rupture. Is that what we're reviewing now? Is that where we're at?
No, we're moving on. I'm going to talk about a little film called Blackberry.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Okay, picture a cell phone and an email machine all in one thing. There is a free wireless internet signal all across North America, and nobody has figured out how to use it.
Simon, before you start with the review of BlackBerry, can we talk about BlackBerries for a quick second?
I'd love to talk about BlackBerries because I had one and they were crackberries for me. So yes, let's talk BlackBerry.
Yeah, look, so for all of my life, I've heard people talk about the crackberry and how they miss their BlackBerry with their touch keyboard and whatnot. And I've always just kind of thought that it was more just something that like tech journalists talk about, because I don't think I ever actually saw a person in real life with a BlackBerry. Like outside of like maybe one or two managers that like I worked under at some point. But outside of that, never saw it.
I can assure you this is this little sort of gray area where maybe our age is plays into it, because I was right in the middle of corporate culture and corporate existence when every single person had a BlackBerry, and they very much became, you know, workplace standard in the days before, you know, the iPhones and everyone had one. BlackBerry was such a part of the business world for the time that I wore a suit and tie. It was, I totally got why there's appeal in this film.
Yeah, I don't get it. I'm confused. I don't understand why there'd be a movie about it. It's baffling to me. When's the movie about the 3 phone? That's what I want to know. I want to hear a movie with polyphonic ringtones. That's what I want to hear.
That'd be a movie. Let me tell you about BlackBerry first of all. As we've pointed out, there was a period sort of from, I'm guessing from the mid-90s, when the two guys played by Jay Baruchel and writer-director Matthew Johnston came up with the idea for what was then called PocketLink. They went to a financing firm, which is where they met tough guy sort of financier Jim Balsillie, played by Glenn Howerton in the film, and played wonderfully by Glenn Howerton. He's such a dick. And this tells the story of about that 14 or 15 year period where BlackBerry had 1/3 of the mobile device market, was taking up just this enormous amount of bandwidth and data, and everything to do with the mobile phone business was all about the crackberry. It flew high and succumbed to greed and avarice very quickly. This film portrays the two founders, Mike Lazaridis, who's Jay Baruchel, and Doug Fregan, as very inexperienced business types who, one, won't grow up at all, and one is forced to grow up very quickly to run his company. All the while, Jim Balsillie is sort of lording over them both, just counting the cash and playing real hardball, which he did play hardball to get the BlackBerry off the ground to start with, but then didn't want to run the company, just wanted to fall back on his mattress covered in money. And there's a bit of that in this film as well. The story itself is kind of familiar in that they have an idea, they fly high, they're not prepared for its crash, and then they all sort of fall into a heap with the Securities Exchange Commission coming after them for a few minor infractions, as well as Apple launching their iPhone and sort of undoing all the good work that they've done with their click-click touchpad keypad and the innovative design of the BlackBerry. And this movie captures all of that in such an entertaining, at times funny, at times sad, but always really energetic and really entertaining way. So even for those who weren't touched by the BlackBerry magic like you, Dan, it's a film well worth seeing just for its skill at telling a really entertaining story.
Look, I will watch anything that has Jay Baruchel in it. So
yeah, me too.
Yeah. Maybe you're the person who talks about this, Simon. I've been thinking about launching a Jay Baruchel podcast where we just examine nothing but the films and TV programs of Jay Baruchel.
I'm a fan. What was that thing he did a couple of years ago, which was sort of Jay Baruchel and the end of the world? He sort of looked at all these different ways, all these different worries of existential crisis that we're going through at the moment.
Oh, that was a like Viceland thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. He fronted, and he had that sort of squeaky, worried, anxious man thing down pat in that, which was really entertaining. I should point out, this is a Canadian production, so you will see Michael Ironside, you will see Saul Rubinek, you will see Martin Donovan in this. They're sort of all the top tier Canadian character actors whose faces you will instantly recognize.
Are they Canadian?
Oh, those three are, yeah.
Really? I thought they just appeared in lots of films that were low budget enough to be shot in Canada.
No, Ironside and Rubinek are definitely Canadian. I'm pretty sure Martin Donovan's Canadian too, because he was best friends with Hal Hartley and they sort of made a lot of movies back in the day. Also, this is in cinemas and should be seen in cinemas, but there is an extended serialized version of the film that's going to air as a three-part miniseries on Canadian television in a couple of months' time, which will probably come out here sometime soon as well. So it might be worth seeing how they blow it up. I don't know if it'll be a very different beast as a three-part miniseries, but it was because this was a really made you understand the technology and the personalities, but didn't get bogged down in them. And I'd hate to see a longer serial version do that. So yeah, BlackBerry is in selected cinemas and is a very entertaining film.
I think I'm just going to wait for the miniseries, Simon. Let's play a clip of the next thing I was going to talk about. It is the Australian remake of the Australian sitcom Mother and Son.
Orange, root vegetable, six letters.
Carrot.
That's it.
Glad you're doing the crossword, Mum.
No, it's my shopping list.
Arthur's been very lonely. You should see the amount of coconut oil he's been going through.
Where are you?
Well, we're at a goat farm.
What the hell are you doing at a goat farm?
You're not kicking me out of my own home, Arthur.
Simon, you'd be of an age where you would have seen Mother and Son, the original sitcom on the ABC.
That's a bit rude. Jesus, Dan, that's a bit ageist. Yes, I am of an age where I do remember it with great fondness and how it was resoundingly championed as some of the best written comedy the country's ever produced in its day.
I haven't heard a quality perspective from you there. Did you like Mother and Son, I guess is probably the question.
Well, yeah, it skewed a bit older than my youthful self at the time, but it was certainly watchable and likable and had great chemistry between the stars. So, yeah, look, I was on board for Mother and Son if I was sitting there having a cup of tea with Nana.
Yeah, so look, this is a show that started airing back in 1984. I was about 4 years old then. It ran through a whopping 42 episodes, Simon. Okay, but finished up in March 1994, so ran for 10 years like on and off because obviously not really a whole lot being produced there, probably six episode seasons, I'm guessing, just, you know, did its thing. I've never really watched it. I know I saw clips of it as a kid.
Have seen the original? Oh, no, it's lovely.
Never watched it.
Cracknell and McDonald were wonderful together. Henry Zips as the other sleazy brother was very, very funny as well. No, it was a terrific piece of writing and local sitcomery.
Yeah. And look, I'm sure that if I had watched it in a day, like I probably would have been quite the fan of it, but it just never really happened. Never really saw it. So I come to the remake with like zero expectation. Okay. Except for one bit of one data point, which is that Matt O'Kine, I quite like Matt O'Kine. I watched his TV program that he made for Stan a couple of years ago. Fucking hated it. Really, really hated that program. Did not care for it. Like it was... Oh, I feel angry just even trying to think about that program right now. Did not care for it. I know I went to a screening that Stan put on for it and they did two episodes back to back. I couldn't make it through to the second episode. I got up and left.
Okay.
And I felt a bit bad about that. But then a colleague who was in a room at the time, he told me that he left a couple of minutes later, but also that there were many people that left in between me and him leaving. So I didn't feel so bad.
He's always been there. Like, he's always been around, but he's never really been a star. He's just kind of been one of those faces that turns up and fills up panel shows or you know, might do some stand-up or something. But he's never really – I remember when there was a real buzz on him, he was sort of destined to go into big things, and it's just never, ever happened.
So the reason why I think there's buzz around him is because I think he's actually generally a pretty good stand-up. I think he's a fairly charismatic person. But yeah, just this TV show I did not care for. So I came to this with some trepidation. And I have to say, after watching the first episode, it's fine. Like, I don't hate it, okay? Right. I think there's like a bit of a charm problem with it. I didn't really necessarily find myself loving the characters by any means. I thought there was, you know, it kind of feels like it was just going through the motions slightly. It's very much a first episode's a premise pilot. It very much sets up where it's going forward. But the thing is, I also found myself at the end of the premise pilot not hugely excited about knowing what happens beyond the premise. So I don't know. I might come back to this one, but here's the thing. Like, most people probably know what this is about. This is, like, I presume that it probably follows the original series. Okay, but for those unfamiliar with Mother and Son, the premise of the revamp, at least, is that the mother is getting a little bit older. There's some accidents happening in the household. And so the son decides that he's going to move in permanently with the mother and just sort of look after her, you know, for the next couple of years as he tries to get his own life back on track because he's just had a long-term relationship fizzle on him. He doesn't really have a lot of career prospects for the moment. And so he needs to get his own life back on track. And at the same time, he feels that he can, you know, help his mother out. In this one, obviously, Matt O'Kine's playing the son, Arthur. In an homage to the original series, he's got a moustache. I kind of feel that the one writing failure of the episode is that they never justify why he'd keep the moustache. Okay, like, everyone makes fun of it on him, and he clearly doesn't seem to be that into the moustache himself. So why not just shave it? Okay, but it'd be funnier if he said, I like the moustache, and everyone else is critical of the moustache. That at least gives it some comedic tension, but like, there's just nothing like that. So that's a bit frustrating. The mother's played by Denise Scott, like, you know, people like Denise Scott, which is perfectly fine. I like Denise Scott. Yeah,
she's good.
Yeah. And then you've also got his sister. Bit of edginess.
She's got an edginess to her that Ruth Cracknell didn't have. Like, she was a very sweet but dithery and didn't quite know she was being such a pain in the ass to her son all the time. Whereas Denise, I imagine the appeal of casting someone like Denise Scott in this was that she could be a little bit of a, like Anne Ramsey in Throw Mama from the Train. She could be that type of mother, but that might make a tough week-to-week watch, but who knows?
Look, she's a bit acidic, but at the same time as well, she's got some heart to her, and that's generally the vibe of the show, acidic but with some heart. You've got some supporting cast members. So the sister of Arthur is played by Angela Nickus-Sullen, who I don't actually really know. Her partner is Virginia Gay, who I have seen in other things. And, you know, perfectly fine. The cast is perfectly fine. I'll give this as a bit of a content spoiler. There is a naked bottom seen in the first episode. It's one of the two leads. And I'll say this, it's not Matt O'Kine.
Denise Scott is very quickly becoming the female version of Glenn Robbins. She'll drop her trousers at any opportunity she can.
Now, I should say, I don't know for sure that we are actually seeing, and I didn't say which character it was, just putting that out there, but I didn't actually see who the bottom belonged to. It's certainly shot. So, I mean, it could be a stunt bottom, is all I'm saying.
Oh, you think they've got a bum double?
Maybe.
That's disappointing. I wanted to see Denise Scott's bottom. I don't like where this conversation's going at all.
Hey, Simon, I think we've got another movie to discuss. Is that true? What else is happening here?
No, we're done. The other thing about the original was that it had a very sort of realistic setting at a time when comedies were very sitcom-y. You know, there was the Hey Dads and there was the All Together Now and those sort of things. There was a very sort of understated realism about the original Mother and Son that also gave it a lot more gravitas than just being another sitcom. Does that come through in the first episode?
Oh, look, it feels realistic in the same way that, you know, it's a single camera sitcom and all things are just kind of shot in the real world nowadays.
Okay.
You know, it's realistic enough. Yeah, I will say it's like, I'm pretty sure that it's supposed to be around Sydney somewhere. Okay, and like, I was kind of curious, like the family home is like a Californian bungalow is the style of house that they live in. And I'd be kind of curious to know what part of Sydney it is. And also, just because part of the story of the program is talking about the financial status of the mother and what the value of the house is, I'd kind of like to know a little bit more about specifically where in Sydney the house is, because to me that actually informs a bit about the show. But as long as there's internal logic, it's fine. And there seems to be that internal logic.
Oh, okay. All right. So mother and son hitting ABC, and I imagine ABC iView, is it already there or happening next week?
Next week. I think it's Wednesday next week, which is what, like the 23rd?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. That's our reviews.
Okay, Simon, what are we moving on to now?
We really should talk about dogs, Dan. This is the intermission segment.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Okay, people have said this podcast has gone to the dogs before, but now it's true. Whoa.
Okay, so the intermission segment we're calling Who's a Good Boy Then? Now, you're right, Strays is in cinemas as we speak, and I didn't get around to seeing this week. I do apologize to those who are counting on my opinion for the new Will Ferrell, Jamie Foxx comedy in which their voices are stuck in the mouths of a bunch of dogs. Some of the reviews are coming through this morning that say it's pretty good, so maybe it's probably worth checking out. We can talk about that at some other time. Now, you and I are devout dog men. And we thought this gives us an opportunity to look back at the great canine characters of movie and TV history. I've done a bit of research on this. I came up with a whole bunch, but I know you don't like me to run off on a tangent when we're talking on these best of sort of things. So I've got my five. Shall we go back and forth?
Back and forth. I've actually got 5.5, but we'll talk about my half at the end.
Well, that doesn't sound like that. All right. Okay. Yeah. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Who's going to kick off?
Look, I'm going to kick off. And before I kick off, obviously we were talking about the divisive attitude around Strays. As we record this, Rotten Tomatoes has it at 54%. So
you can split right down the middle.
Take that for what it is.
I mean, I think it looks like the sort of thing that you're either going to think is fun. It's not like I'm going to bring any sort of perspective to it being either funny or not funny based on my own opinion. It looked like the sort of thing which will get a few laughs and be on a streamer within the month, but we'll see
how we go. Yeah, look, I'm looking forward to seeing it on a streamer. Okay.
Yeah, me too.
I might see it in December next week. I don't know. I've got a few nights to myself. I might do that. Okay. Here we go, Simon. Number one, and
well, number what five, count me down. Are we in any order here?
No, you can't order a dog. Okay, first of all, the number one rule with dogs, Simon, is that the greatest dog in the world is your dog.
That is very true. In fact, that reminds me of a wonderful quote which says, heaven is a place where your father is a boy and your dog can talk. And that is a beautiful quote that has always stuck with me. And that sounds about right. So
there you go. So you can't numerically number a dog list because the best dog will always be your own dog. So it just can't be done. So here we go. In no particular order, okay, I'm starting. My first dog I'm going to mention is Murray from Mad About You. Okay.
Beautiful.
My rationale for Murray from Mad About You is that I feel that for TV dogs, the best ones are the ones where like the least is expected of them. Okay. Mm-hmm. They should operate like a dog in real life, which is that largely stuff's going on and they're just sitting on the couch. Okay. And that's what I liked about Murray. Murray is featured right through Mad About You, just sitting around in the background. Occasionally you would see Murray takes the foreground and the action would be centered around him. Okay, but always, whenever that's happening, it said more about the owners than it ever did about Murray specifically. Murray's free to be his own creature, and I always liked that about him. Great Murray moments include, I believe, in the very first season, there's a very memorable opener, like a cold open on the episode, because, you know, sitcoms have like that sort of minute and a half cold open, and then they go to the opening credits. There's a great one where Jamie and Paul come home from doing some shopping or wherever they've been. They walk through the lounge room. They go into their kitchen. They swing the door open. And if you remember, their kitchen had a little island table in the middle. And Murray's just standing on the table, just staring forward. And you don't know how he got up there. You don't know why he's there. And Paul just says, "This is new." And, you know, that's it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice, nice, nice. All right. So you let off with Murray. I am going to go down the animated dog route, and I had a couple to choose from here. It could have been Gromit from Wallace and Gromit. It could have been Doug from Up. But I'm going to settle on, of course, Santa's Little Helper from the Simpsons episodes, right there from almost from day one.
The first episode is the Santa's Little Helper episode. It's the origin.
Exactly right, where they get where they go to the racetrack and get Santa's Little Helper. So, so many wonderful, joyful moments, and a character so perfectly defined, as with the rest of the Simpsons characters. I'm surprised Santa's Little Helper hasn't sort of gone down the route of Snoopy and just been a merchandising sort of bonanza extravaganza, because I think there's a lot of love for Santa's Little Helper. And I do mention Snoopy, who is a wonderful movie and TV dog, but originated as a comic strip. So I didn't include Snoopy in there, who obviously I love dearly. So I'm going to go with Santa's Little Helper as my entry point in this, our favorite dog segment.
Question. How did you feel about Laddie?
Laddie
was the dog that Bart ended up getting when he traded in Santa's Little Helper for being a bad dog.
Yeah, the gorgeous collie. It was a fun episode, but I was glad to see Laddie out the back seat. Sorry about the noise I made.
Yeah, same. No, because people just take ownership of their dog, regardless how terrible a dog it may be, because that dog should still be the best dog in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we'll talk. We're the same people when it comes to dog, I guarantee.
Yeah. Question. Sorry, if we did a cat list, would you add Snowball 2 to your list? There's only one answer to this.
Yes, I would, but it would be a very small list. I don't think cats have had the impact in the world of film and TV that dogs have.
Simon, that's the incorrect answer. The correct answer is no, we would never do a segment about the best cats in the world. So why are you even wasting our time with this?
That's exactly right. In fact, now I'm just obsessed with trying to come up with five cats.
You can't do it because
Pet Sematary. But it'd be Pet Sematary. It'd be how horrible they are to us.
Yeah, who are the greatest cat villains of all time? Yeah, maybe then we could talk. Yeah.
Woman. All right.
Well, no, she's a woman. She's just cat themed.
Cat like, yeah. She's feline. She's feline esque.
Yeah. Well, feline adjacent. It doesn't matter. My second dog is even less animated than Murray the dog was from Mad About You. I'm thinking about Buck from Married with Children. Again, Buck, he does even less than Murray did on Mad About You. He's just in the background, just doing his thing. He's just sitting on couches, just being a good dog.
I don't remember Buck too well. I didn't watch a lot of Married with Children. It wasn't my sort of thing.
Oh, what? You're too good for it.
What?
are you not going to be coming to the No Ma'am chapter meeting in the next couple of weeks?
What breed was Buck? Actually, what breed was Murray? Murray was like a little fluffy terrier thing, wasn't it?
No, he was more like a golden retriever.
Oh, was he? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what was Buck?
Also, I should say I'm not great with dog breeds. Okay. Just putting that out there. Not great with them.
Well, I don't know what Santa's Little Helper was. What was a greyhound, I guess, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or a variation there.
Right? Well, yes, because they got it from a greyhound track.
Yeah. All right, the next one I'm going to throw in there. I'm keen to see if we cross paths. I think we may sort of cross our wires a little bit with this one.
If you don't have one of these three dogs on your list, the podcast is done. This is going to be the last episode.
All right. My next one in is Rolf from the Muppets.
Ah, you know what? I had him on my list and I scratched him out.
And you scratched him off. I was wondering. I was going to leave that open to you because I know you're a mad Muppets fan. But I am going to go with Rolf from the Muppets. He was always a really sort of unusual presence on that show because whereas everyone else was kind of crazy and a bit zany and had this bizarre sort of world around them, Rolf could always just sit there and lean over the piano. And he reminded me a little bit of Linus. Who's the one from the Peanuts script who's always playing the piano? Charles. Is that Charles?
Schroeder. Yeah.
Schroeder. He reminded me in a similar sort of way that he was always just obsessed with his piano, over the piano, playing it cool, being himself, and that's kind of what Rolf was on the Muppets. And I loved him for that. And he could be very funny when he needed to be, but he was one of my favorite dogs. It's very strange that my first two are totally fictitious cartoon and Muppets, but that's going to change any minute now. So you go for it. What's your next?
Well, I will say the reason why I didn't include Rolf or Santa's Little Helper, who I also did think about, is because animated and puppets. I figured they weren't real dogs, and so therefore, yeah. sort of moved
pretend
on.
Pretend you didn't say that.
Okay. Well, you know, it is what
don't
it is.
Listen to him, kids. They are real dogs. Don't listen to him. Uncle Dan saying nasty things now.
Number three on my list, Simon, from a film that I adored. It's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a dog called Brandy who, come on, the first time that we meet Brandy, who doesn't fall in love with that dog? We meet Brandy inside the terrible murder home that the Cliff character's living in. That's more a caravan than a motor home. And then at the end has a very notable, very history-changing sequence where Brandy helps dispose of the Manson family and their assassination attempts on the Hollywood starlet up the hills.
Great scene. A great scene.
Incredible.
He's one, and the chemistry that he has with Brad Pitt and just the understanding they have.
Her name is Brandy.
She has with Brad Pitt is just wonderful. Yeah, great choice.
Okay, what have you got? Please, you can't do better than that, surely.
Yeah, well, I'm leaning into sort of my darker nature. I'm going to put Cujo in here. One of my favorite scary movies, one of the great dog characters in film. Yes, total villain. Well, see, I started to feel a little bit sad for Cujo because he got bit by a bat when he stuck his head inside that hole. And I can't believe I just said that sentence. But it was not his personality that was causing him to do all these awful things and attacking little Danny and his mum inside that car. It was the rabies taking effect. So he was an absolute force to be reckoned with, but he was a not a classic villain in the sense, but he became one, I guess, kind of like Jaws was for sharks. But I love Cujo, and the more I watch it, I realize what a sad and wonderful film it really is and what a great performance Dee Wallace Stone gives in the lead. So I'm going with Cujo, the St. Bernard, who was old dribbly, bloody face and everything.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Number four on my list. Again, not in order, just the order I'm giving it out. Don't read anything into it. I've gone for another movie, Baxter, as seen in a great film, Anchorman.
Wow.
Very memorable performance.
Very funny.
Yeah. Yes, one of the saddest experiences I've ever had in a cinema was watching Baxter being drop-kicked off the side of the bridge. Difficult moment, but Baxter lived on. And he was a good boy. He was a smart boy. And Simon, there's a type of joke that happens in movies and TV shows, which I occasionally hear criticized. It's that moment where a child, for example, is acting wise beyond their years. Okay, like there's that joke. Yeah. I love that joke. I can't get enough of that joke. Put it in every movie. Put it in every TV show. I'm there for it. Similarly, I love the joke where a dog barks and the human understands implicitly what's being said. And that's clearly what happens with Baxter and Ron Burgundy. Anyway, I love that joke as well. Put in everything. I'm base. I'm shallow. I will take it. I love that goat. I love it. I can't, just more.
All right. Staying in the world of horror, I was going to include E-Buzz, the beautiful golden retriever from the film Poltergeist, who only had a few small moments but made them memorable. But instead, I'm going to include the Norwegian dog, an Alaskan Malamute, in fact, from John Carpenter's The Thing. The film opens with it running across the snow, the helicopter chasing it, trying to shoot it, trying to drop hand grenades on it, for God's sake. What could this dog possibly represent to the crazy people in the helicopter? And as it slinks around the legs of the tables and all the men, the Americans in the Arctic camp, it takes on such a degree of menace. And then when it finally changes, oh my God. So I don't even know if it has a name. I'll probably get people ring up and email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com to tell me the name of the dog in The Thing. But, yeah, it was one of the great support characters in one of the great horror films ever.
Okay, fifth on my list, Simon. A dog named Einstein. He's in Back to the Future.
He's the
first time-traveling dog I've seen. And that's not true. That's not true at all. My line here is that it's got to be a real dog and not an animated dog because obviously...
You're thinking of Peabody and Sherman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So no. But Einstein, I think great dog. Very charming. Big fan.
Wonderful dog. Great dog. Yeah. All right. Okay, we're down to my last one.
Yeah, and it'd be Einstein, Baxter, or Brandy, or else this podcast is finished. I think I declared that.
Oh, baby, I think I'm going out on a high with this one. I do want to acknowledge some of the great dogs, the Benjis, the Rin Tin Tins, the Lassie, the Scooby, the Plutos, the Totos. They're in there, but these are the ones that mean the most to us. And if I said to you the word Farfel, what would you immediately think of?
Which one's Farfel? I know Farfel by name, and I'm trying to think. Like, Farfel's not the dog from Seinfeld, is it?
That is exactly who it is.
Yeah.
Never even appears on screen, but it probably has some of the best comedic moments in the Seinfeld series ever. Yeah,
but that's not the dog. That's everyone reacting against the dog.
It's the dog. I'm sticking with Farfel. That was a fairly broad set of rules we had for this segment. Farfel makes me laugh and laugh, and certainly their reactions around him were terrific. So I knew it had raised controversy because he doesn't actually appear on screen, but Farfel, the dog that was abandoned by the drunk on the plane and then had to stay with Jerry for all those days where they couldn't go to see, was it Prognosis Negative?
Prognosis Negative.
They couldn't get out to see it because of the dog. And Jerry wanted to take it to the pound, and Elaine says, Jerry, you know what they do to them? They keep them for a few days, and then they kill them. And Jerry says, really? How late are they open?
I will say, I actually don't care for that episode at all. And anytime it comes on, I skip straight past it. But I did watch it again recently as part of my commitment to watching every episode of Seinfeld again.
That's what I figured. Don't you baritize my final.
Oh, no, I just didn't care for it, you know. Okay. I can't criticize the taste that I have. So my last one, and this was going on my list, off my list. I couldn't really work out if I wanted to put him on there. And this was me just trying to be a bit contrarian and come up with the most obscure dog that I could. But I thought about the character from the animated TV program Liquid Television back in the day, and it was a character called Dog Boy. But I couldn't really decide, was he dog, was he boy? And so he didn't make my list for that reason.
Dog Boy, I have no recollection of that whatsoever. And I was a Liquid TV fan, but I don't remember.
I'll send you some clips.
Unusual.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was dog. But anyway, I think he was more boy than dog.
More boy than dog.
Yeah.
Yes, we've all been called that. All right. That was the intermission. Now, Dan Barris, what else have you been watching? You've got an interesting one here on the running sheet. You've stumbled across one of the most acclaimed films of the year. I'm keen to see your thoughts.
So, look, last year, everybody's putting together their best film lists of the year, and quite a number of people added this feature film on there called Triangle of Sadness. Now, I know that you reviewed the movie on this here podcast. When you did that review, basically, I wasn't listening to you. Yeah, just being real, just being honest, okay?
It's fine. I understand.
Yeah, I'm just saying. But anyway, I knew that you were very favorable of it. I knew that largely a lot of critics really enjoyed it. There were just general conversation around it seemed pretty high. But what struck me about the movie, and the reason why I don't think I made an active choice to go and see it, is that while everyone was saying that, yeah, it's a really good movie, nobody seemed particularly passionate about it. Like, there didn't seem to be a lot of advocacy for this movie. And so, like, I kind of feel as though a movie like that, if it really is something which people just genuinely love, there should be a bit of that everything everywhere all at once kind of vibe around it. You know, people sort of saying, you've got to see this movie. It's very good. And like, I just heard none of that. I just heard people sort of do a bit of chin stroke and go, yes, it's very good. I couldn't really get my head around what it was. I heard it was about modeling. I heard it was on a boat. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't get my head around what it was. There was no clear sell as to why I should check it. But I was sitting there with my lady on the couch and we were looking for something to watch. And I saw it there in the Paramount Plus library. And I thought, you know what? Maybe today's the day. I'm going to press play on it. We'll give it half an hour. Like, you know, if we're into it, we'll keep watching. It's like a 2.5 hour runtime. Like, it's not a easy commitment film. Okay. Press play. Within 5 minutes, I was deeply hooked into it. It was funny. It was strange. It was a little bit weird. I couldn't work out where it was going. There was a guy who made some very good points about his girlfriend not picking up the bill. I related to that. I thought, yes, I can embrace the conversation that you're having right now. And not just from like women around, but there's just some people that never reach for a bill. And that always annoys me. They don't even think to do it, or at least they don't make any pretense that they've thought about doing it. Anyway.
I believe you side with that character, but yeah, fair enough.
Oh, well, I was supposed to side with her. Both of them
are
awful.
She was also fairly objectionable. Yeah, no, they were both terrible people, that's for sure.
No, everyone in this movie is an awful, objectionable person. But anyway, I will say...
You got to, and you love the vomiting scene? Tell me you love the vomiting scene.
Here's the thing, Simon, I think you've said too much. Here's the thing that people need to know about this movie. It is better that you go into it not knowing anything about this movie, okay? Just press play on it, go on the ride, okay? That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
I think that it's... There is a moment sort of, I'm going to say in the middle of the movie, that I think stretches a little bit longer than it needs to. Okay, like that's the only criticism I have. I think that there is a sequence which, I mean, there's, I'm going to call it the fireworks sequence, so I don't really sort of tip my hat as to what it is. Okay, there's lots of explosions happening. It's interesting and fun. Okay, but there's just an element that happens straight after the explosions that just runs out a little bit too long, and I don't know, it loses me a little bit with that. But broadly, this deserves to be people's favorite film of last year. I think it's very good. I don't understand why people weren't grabbing their friends by the arms and saying, go and see this movie.
Oh, they sort of were. It was one of the top grossing, limited release films last year.
Yeah, but come on. Last year, the 2022 list of top grossing limited films.
Well, it wasn't it, but it was. It's like you say, it's also a tough sell. It's not an easy film to sell, but those that saw it were deeply enamored by it.
People
such great films, Ruben Östlund. Force Majeure is one of my favorite films. The Square and now this. His films are always so interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to check out The Square now, which I haven't seen. Yeah. Interesting filmmaker, very interesting film, worth looking at. If you haven't seen it, don't read anything up about it. Just press play and put aside 2.5 hours of your life.
I have also been watching, on top of everything else, I read a press release this morning that the new Prime series The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, starring one Sigourney Weaver. She came to the lovely South Australian hinterland to shoot this dark domestic drama. This film, this series is apparently doing blockbuster numbers all over the world.
Where did you hear this?
This came through as a press release from the Prime Video people. They
oh, really? Why would they lie?
Why would they lie? No, they've cited that it's, you know, top four in 78 countries and top 10.
Yeah, Simon, sorry, what third party have verified this?
Hey, I'm going with whatever the internet tells me. That's done us just fine for 3 years now. So
No. It's done you fine, and I find myself having to question every time that you bring one of these facts to the table.
What do you have that says otherwise?
No, I've got nothing, because nobody is talking about this being a huge performing production other than Amazon.
Well, who else would talk about it being a huge performer? That's what they do. They promote their work from within.
Yeah, Nielsen, one of the other third-party organizations that publish regular lists of well-performing TV programs and movies.
You're going to make me find this. Let's have a look. It'll be here somewhere. You're going to make me find this on air, literally on air.
Oh, Simon, how about we just continue on with the podcast, because you're not going to find it.
Well, the fact is, this is a major new Australian release that I thought I'd have a look at. And it's beautifully made and beautifully shot, a little bit dark and a bit soap opery in its first episode. It reminded me a little bit of those, what were those Flower in the Attic books back in the 80s, the Victoria?
Yeah, Flowers in the Attic.
Victoria Andrews books or something. Yeah, it had that sort of feel to it. Apparently it goes, the first episode is quite sort of dark and comes with a warning that some scenes sort of may be difficult for viewers, and that's true. But it's also and when Sigourney certainly turns up, she carries a lot of weight in the performance. Great Australian cast, Asher Keddie, Leah Purcell, a lot of good people up in there, and the young actress who's playing the kid who's at the centre of all this, Alice, is wonderful as well. So I don't know, I'm sort of keen. It's soap opera, but it's high-end soap opera. And if it's doing the sort of numbers that Amazon is claiming it's doing, then it's maybe another success for the local industry.
Yes, they said it's the top five in 78 countries they have, and the top three in 42 countries, as per Amazon Prime.
Yep.
You know that whole writer's strike that's on at the moment and the actors striking, and one of the things they're upset about is the lack of transparency in numbers, Simon?
No, I don't know that. But anyway, that's there now, but who knows? Okay, all right, fine, whatever.
You could say you'd want to watch it because it's got Sigourney Weaver in it. That's fine.
Yeah. No. I didn't. I hadn't gone to watch it until I read some of those numbers and figures and understood that it was one of their sort of high-end prestige releases for the year, and it's a kind of a big deal that she's coming down to make stuff here in Australia. She's been in here before. She made a movie a few years ago. I don't even remember the name of it, but she doesn't mind traveling the world.
Sorry, Simon, for years haven't we made fun of productions which have to have that one American actor that we've imported in to star in an Australian production?
Not if they're good. I mean, that's an easy way to get sort of overseas dollars and lock in sales and all that sort of stuff. And yes, we've been tough on it for that. But if the actual material is good, then yeah, why not?
Mm. Anyway, Simon, let's move on. There's some trivia. There's some history. There's some birthdays. Let's do it.
You're so contrarian. You baritize. That's the baritization of the podcast. When I come to the table with something and you go full Barrett on it.
You know what I want? I just want some hard numbers, Simon, if you're going to make these grand claims. That's all I'm after, just some hard numbers. All right. Keep it hard. That's my motto.
Okay. Well, here's some hard numbers for you. In history, August 21, 1942.
Sorry, Simon, have you vetted these dates? Because every week...
I have vetted these dates. The internet does not lie.
Okay, what have we got?
August 21, 1942. Which Disney animated classic debuts, setting in motion traumatized generations of children for years to come? Which Disney animated classic debuts 21st August 1942?
I was about to say one, but I don't think that's right. I think we're talking about Bambi, right?
We are talking about Bambi. What were you going to say?
I was going to say Dumbo, and I was thinking about the death of Dumbo's mother, but... Oh, no, not her mother. Like, it's that just kept Bambi. Away, isn't it? Or...
Yes, no, it was Bambi's mother that died that traumatised...
What happened in Dumbo, though? Did the mother die, or did...
He was separated from the mother. No, he was separated, okay. And she sings that song and rubs it, you know, puts her trunk around him. From the mind, August 25, 1979, from the mind of blockbuster author Sidney Sheldon, which husband and wife detective show debuts on this day, August 25, 1979?
Husband and wife detectives. I don't know if I've got their names in the right order, but it's Heart. Yeah, okay.
That's funny. Heart to Heart. August 27, 2004, the Jet Li action film Hero achieves what feat for the first time at the US box office?
Now, I don't know. I'm taking a bit of a stab on this one. Like, I'm pretty sure that Hero was one of those, like, post Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, like, waifu sort of thing. So I'm going to guess it's the first time that a non-English language film topped the charts.
All right. Let's go with that then. Yes, it was the first time. It was the first time that a Chinese language... film topped the charts. I'm wondering if it was the first time any language. That's an interesting one.
Well, English language films tend to do it pretty well.
No, not English. Non-English
language.
Because this was the first Chinese language film to become number one. I looked at this. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon never hit number one on the US box office, but Hero did.
No, but it was that thing that we were talking about, well, that I was talking about on a podcast last week, which is those films that used to stick around for like forever in the cinemas. And that was definitely one of those films.
Not for sure.
One of my favorite moments was going into the what would be now Event Cinemas, but I think back then it was Birch, Carroll and Coyle in Brisbane. Going into the ones at what was then Westfield Garden City, and seeing a sign up like advising people that it's not in English, being Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. that clearly had some complaints, which is weird considering that Sunnybank is just up the road. And if people know Brisbane, Sunnybank's a like Asian cultural mecca.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Oh, nice. Strong Asian population and some amazing foods.
I'm hungry.
And good people.
Okay, this birthday quiz, I'm keen to see if you get this. I think this is really tough, but we'll see.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
Okay, hit
August 24, August 24, 1965, the beautiful Marley Matlin.
Correct.
August 24, 1964, funny man Dana Gould.
He's beautiful August in his own way.
August 27, 1953, Peter Stormare. And August 28, 1961, Jennifer Coolidge. Now, what could this disparate band of individuals possibly have in common?
Give me each one by name again. First name.
Marley.
I like her name, like full name.
Marley Matlin.
Ball Girl, next.
Dana Gould.
Love sitting in a hole.
Love sitting in a hole. I don't know what that means. But
well, clearly Peter you don't actually Stormare. Really know like anything about what you're talking about here, Simon, but go
Stormare.
On. Removalist, familiar with the game of Frogger.
And Jennifer Coolidge.
Masseuse.
They all had guest spots and very funny guest spots on the Seinfeld series. You are right, Dan Barrett. Well done. Season the, 5, the episode
Dana,
6.
The Dana Gould character. Sorry.
Hang on. Season 5, episode 6, Marley Matlin played Laura in the episode The Lip Reader. Season 9, episode
and she,
5.
And she was? What was she? She was a ball girl.
She was the ball girl in the at the tennis. That's some of the funniest things in it. Dana Gould played Frankie Merman in the Junk Mail episode, season
and
9, episode 5.
Do you remember what his deal was?
I don't know that episode that well. That wasn't on one of my sort
It's a terrible episode. Like a shockingly bad episode. It's the van one. And this guy, he's got a history of any time that he gets overly stressed, he used to run out into the woods and sit in a hole.
That was Frankie Merman, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. The great character actor Peter Stormare, who many of us will know from Fargo and so many films, he played Slippery Pete in season 9, episode 18, The Frogger.
And he was one of the guys helping them get the he was one of the guys helping them get the Frogger machine across the road.
That's right. And according to IMDb, in her acting debut or in her credited debut, Jennifer Coolidge was Jodie the masseuse, season 5, episode 9, which was peak Seinfeld for me. That was the season 4 and 5 are just the episodes I've watched over and over again. So I've seen the masseuse many, many times. Yeah, she was the masseuse. So you're right. They all had guest shots on Seinfeld. I had a tough time finding a connection this week for the birthday quiz. And we had people in there like Blake Lively and a whole bunch of big stars, and I just couldn't tee them all up, tie them all together. So I stumbled across this.
I think that's a good connection, and it was genuinely a challenge in a way. I mean, it wasn't a challenge for me because, you know, Seinfeld, but I think it's better than some of the other ones, which is they've all been actors.
I've never done that. You don't realize I've been doing quizzes like this for like 30 years. This used to be my thing when I did radio reviews on 2UE in Sydney. I'd do a couple of DVDs, then I'd do this quiz thing that I thought up, and it was, we had dozens of listeners.
Oh, so nothing's really changed.
Nothing's really changed at all, no. All right. I think that brings us to the end of the podcast, doesn't it? Boy, you've got some editing to do. People don't know the magic that goes on behind the scenes when we really stuff up a recording.
We only really stuffed up twice, and now we're writing really clear edit points, so it's actually going to be fine, Simon. It's going to be fine. Oh, although I'm going to have to edit this part out of the end of the podcast. God.
Oh, really?
No, not really.
Because this is all good. This is the real. This is the real people stuff. This is what they listen for.
Yeah, we keep it real. The honesty of what we're doing here.
Okay. All right. Good stuff. I'm going to go and watch all the missed episodes of The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart. It's huge.
Sure. I mean, you've never watched The Sopranos, but yeah, prioritize that program. Yeah, sure. Go for it.
That's very true. All right. Do your sign-off thing. I got work to do.
I love the idea that people need to go and watch the most important things to watch before they just watch whatever they actually want to watch. It's like, Dan, you've never seen The Seventh Seal, but yeah, go ahead and watch Strays. Guys.
That's very true. It's, yeah. Go on.
This is the end of the podcast. My name's been Dan Barrett. You can find me on the internet. I do a daily newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. Find it at alwaysbewatching.com. Each day I do a rundown of the big stories in TV streaming and a little bit of film and some virtual reality and some games and whatever else people are watching on screens. I do that on Fridays as a newsletter that comes out, which has got nothing but the TV shows and the movies that have launched on streaming that week. So when you're sitting there on a weekend thinking, gosh, I'd love to watch something new. What should I watch? There's your list. It's right there. It's in the email. Anyway, that's at alwaysbewatching.com. You can find that as well. Find me on Twitter at the Dan Barrett. Find me on Threads at the Dan Barrett. Find me on Blue Sky. Yeah, Blue Sky. I'm there.
Is that going to take off? Is that going to be a thing? I've put the festival on Blue Sky and I'm not getting a whole lot of
I'm really frustrated. I've noticed a little bit of a like revitalization of Blue Sky in the last couple of days. Ever since Twitter got rid of, sorry, X got rid of TweetDeck, people seem to be jumping onto the Blue Sky a little bit more. But yeah, we'll see.
All right, I better get on that. I'm Simon Foster, for those of you who don't know after all this time. We've got socials everywhere, at Screen Watching Podcast on Facebook, at Screen _ Watching on the X. Do we have to really say that? Our Screen Watching YouTube channel. This coming Friday night at 6 o'clock, I do believe one Dan Barrett will be standing in front of a screen and welcoming the hordes of people coming to the Science Fiction Film Festival Brisbane for the screening of Electric Dreams, which I'm very excited about. And I have to talk to you about creating some kind of screen behind you with your Always Be Watching logo on it, because I want to give you some kind of promotion. So,
yeah, that's good, because I'm not being paid.
Yes. No, you're not being paid. I'm not being paid. The festival is rolling out this week, 24th to the 27th in Sydney and Brisbane. Go to sydneysciencefictionfilmfestival.com.au for all your science fiction movie going needs.
Okay, fantastic. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week with more things we've been watching on screens. And yeah, as Simon said, he does have this film festival running. There's some really good titles in there. I'm going to be presenting Electric Dreams in Brisbane, but it's also playing in both Melbourne and Sydney, I believe, but without me.
Yes, it is.
Just how it goes. There's going to be a screening of The Last Starfighter. There's going to be the Twilight Zone movie. There's going to be a whole bunch of sci-fi films. You look like you're about to say something.
No, I'm just so excited for Twilight Zone, the movie. I haven't seen that on the big screen. I never saw it once on the big screen, countless times on VHS, but to see it back on the big screen is going to be a big deal. So
Yeah,
I'm very excited. I've had two filmmakers drop in just suddenly from overseas. I'm getting Sara Cirilla, who's coming over for her Finnish film called Memory of Water, and she'll be in Sydney for a Q&A. And this German filmmaker called Tibor Baumann is coming to the what I've found out quite by accident was the world premiere of his film at my festival. He pitched his producers and they paid for him to fly out here. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. It is going to be awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, buddy. Look forward to it.
But yeah, so find that one at the terribly named Sydney Science Fiction Film. What's the URL? Well, it's terribly named because it's called Sydney, but like it's in three cities.
Well, I can't keep changing. I can't have like three different websites juggling. I have enough trouble with one.
It's
Sydney Science Fiction Filmfestival.com.au. It's all under the Sydney Science Fiction. Go to there and you can't miss it on Facebook and Twitter.
Couldn't you just rebrand the whole thing as Australian Science Fiction Film Festival?
Oh, then you got to register the names and you got to buy new URLs.
Oh, yeah. So let's just confuse everyone else outside of Sydney. GoDaddy.com.
I tried to go to Darwin and Perth and Adelaide last year and like nine people turned up. So I can't call it Australian Film Festival.
We call it Australia. It's in Australia.
You keep boasting how intelligent Queensland people are. Can't they just figure out it's a science fiction film festival in Brisbane?
Yeah, but they're really smart in that they look at it and they analyze the elements of information there and they go, Sydney, oh, wait, that's not here. And then they move on.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll see. I'm counting on you to bring hordes of people into at least Electric Dreams and hopefully other sessions as well.
I can promise you up to three people.
Wow. That covers my operating costs. It actually does cover my operating costs. All right. Thank you, Dan. Goodbye.
Okay, folks, we'll be back next week. And check out Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival. Get on Google because it's not going to come up easily as a website.